in a very critical sense. I feel like I know a lot of my friends who are doing things that are super critical, and I just somehow don't feel like I should be patting myself on the back. I know I've worked very hard and I continue to work very hard. I would like to think that I will never give somebody an opportunity to say that she's phoning it in, because I just don't believe that. I wasn't raised in that kind of environment. But I know that it is a job and I'm deeply grateful for it, but it doesn't define me.
Hello, hello. Welcome to Tuckered Out with me, Ami Tucker. So when I got married like a billion years ago, we moved to India for about 3 years for the hubby's job. I might have mentioned that, you know, maybe like 100 times on the podcast. And while I was sitting there trying to figure out my life, while the husband went to work and I was sitting at home in India with no job, I ended up trying out like 4 different career paths. One, going to DJ school, because, you know, why not? And the other led me to a freelancing gig with Condé Nast, specifically Vogue India. And I can tell you guys, the experience was as cool as it sounds. I officially felt cool. So the fact that I get to talk to the current head of editorial content, they don't say editor-in-chief anymore, just FYI, is so full circle, square, whatever shape you want to call it. Rochelle Pinto is the head of editorial content for Vogue India. She has had quite a career and is exactly how you think a Vogue head would be: poised, intelligent, well-spoken, beautiful. And on top of it, yeah, she is down to earth. She's all those things. And if you were wondering, she does get advice from Anna Wintour. No big deal. It was an absolute blast getting to know her and getting educated on what is currently happening in India, which is a lot, with fashion, content, beauty, and, well, all things Vogue. Please enjoy my interview with Rochelle Pinto. Obviously, congrats on your new role, editor-in-chief of Vogue. We all know it's an iconic brand. I know you started about 6 months ago, correct?
I mean, it feels a lot longer, but no, it's just been about five months.
So how does it feel? Like, basic questions. Obviously, you've been in journalism and working with various magazines for a while, but Vogue, how does it feel?
I mean, it feels like a homecoming for me, because I was at Vogue for 2 years, about 12 years ago, and I was the digital fashion writer then. So in many ways, it feels like a system that I understand. It's a brand, obviously, that I've grown up with. And I was lucky to have worked with the original team that built it. So in many ways, I've had the training. But then I left and then I went out and saw the world and explored other possibilities. So I feel like the prodigal daughter who returned with a lot of knowledge and a very healthy appetite. And for me, the big thing is that a lot of people ask me, oh, so what's your vision and what's the new Vogue? And I have to caution everybody that this is a slow living process. This is a journey, taking everything that we've learned from the amazing women who built the platform and finding a way to take this into the future.
Rewind back. How old is Vogue India?
17 years.
So it's still kind of a baby, right?
It is a baby. It's just about learned to walk.
It's trying to get out of that mom and dad's house right now, basically.
Yeah. It's a very young brand. And obviously, we are in the privileged position of having a young audience. So we have to do something of a tightrope walk where we don't alienate the people who sort of first gave Vogue support and first bought into the brand when it entered India. But at the same time, we have to constantly challenge ourselves. Like, what does the younger audience want? What are the people in other parts of India, not just Bombay and Delhi and the metros, as we call them in India? What are these emerging markets looking at? How can we fully represent India in its totality and in its various flavors? So that's a work in progress, and I'm learning every day.
That must be challenging, because obviously Vogue, you think of Vogue, right? And correct me if I'm wrong, but you think of Vogue, high fashion, luxury markets. So knowing what I know of India, I don't know what the percentage is of rural India, but how do you reach those people that feel like they are maybe not connected to those markets? How do you get to that audience?
I don't think that a cookie cutter approach works in that I don't assume that everybody's going to be interested in fashion or everybody's going to be interested in beauty. But I do think that if we apply our minds to it and if we lead with empathy, we can find pieces of content that work for everyone. For example, we've just launched Vogue Weddings as a vertical. Now, weddings is something that doesn't matter where you come from. In India, as you know, there's a deep interest in it. And so we try to find a way to create pieces of content that cut across various strata. We very recently did a story on, you know, a tattoo artist who has taken her tribe's original tattoo art form and like literally put it onto canvases that are now being displayed in Melbourne. Now, I know that that is not going to get the same number of people reading that story as, let's say, Alia Bhatt's newest outfit. But I feel like it's, for us, it matters to be able to represent parts of this country that even we find ourselves discovering as relatively sheltered individuals. Because of the country, its diversity, and also the number of languages that we speak here, it feels like many different countries in one, right? It's so enjoyable to discover parts of your nation that even you didn't know.
Right. It feels like there's constantly different layers to India. And again, the 4 years I lived there, I feel like I just touched upon it like briefly. And I think it's really smart. I've seen the weddings that you guys are covering. I think it's so smart that you guys are covering unique and different content. Obviously, we love the Bollywood coverage, the outfits, the big glam. But I think there is a sense of content fatigue in all areas. And so to bring that fresh content from India and showing other parts of India, I think is so smart. And it's interesting to all of us outside the country as well. So I love the wedding. I definitely check those out. Okay, so your role, editor-in-chief, such a huge umbrella. So I know you're overseeing the vision and content, but what does that mean to the layman? Like, explain your role.
So it's now been rebranded as head of editorial content.
Okay.
So editor-in-chief itself has gone away. Oh. And I think that there's a certain amount of,
Okay.
There's a certain amount of democratization, I think, that was the goal. And also, I think that Condé Nast is a legacy company, but it also tries to innovate. And I feel like there were a lot of trappings that were hung on this term, editor-in-chief. And in doing away with that term altogether, though, of course, everyone has their own conspiracy theories about why this happened and, you know, what was the real agenda behind it. What I find to be particularly refreshing is that it really allows you more space to discover your version of leadership and your version of the editorial role. When I first joined, I have to be honest, I was like, oh, you know, will I be able to take public transport or will that be frowned upon? And, all these like weird ideas that you have in your head and, can I just go to my favorite restaurant or my favorite dive bar? Or is it now, you know, I can only go to a certain kind of place? And I think that this move of changing that term really did away with a lot of that legacy, these boundaries that we invented, honestly, none of them are real. What it means to the layperson is that tomorrow when somebody is angry with a piece of content that is on Vogue India in any form, they're, you know, and they yell on Instagram, they like,
any platform, right, yes.
Private wars on X or whatever we like to call Twitter now. I'm the person responsible for that. Even if I had nothing to do with it, even if I didn't write that piece of content or I didn't take that photo, the liability is entirely mine and the credit is shared. That is what it means.
Okay, that's a good summary of it all. So I got to ask because it's Vogue. So then can we safely say that Anna Wintour is no longer editor-in-chief of Vogue? U.S.
Anna Wintour is now the global, actually just quickly Google this so I get it correct because the terminology
has
changed.
When you think of her, you just think of chief, right? Of everything.
She is though in many ways. And I think that her remit has extended as well. She's now the global editorial director of content. And so what's great for me is that before it would have been, you know, we wouldn't have had much interaction with her as Vogue India, let's say about 7 or 8 years ago, it would have been relatively siloed. But now she's actively involved in all of the markets. So what that means for me is that I get to learn from a legend. You know, I get to actually have FaceTime with her and understand her point of view. And what is so fascinating about Anna is she always has more energy than anybody else. She's the only person able to withstand like 2-hour, 3-hour long meetings without necessarily getting exhausted or at least not showing it. And she's also so attuned to what's happening. She understands market sensitivities, cultural sensitivities. Sometimes I'll be showing her the upcoming issue and she'll be like, is that okay culturally? So from that perspective, she really is the global director of content. You know, she has an understanding of the entire content universe in a way that is amazing. It's amazing to watch.
That's why she is who she is, right?
I feel like everybody asked me, like, what's it like? And I was like, in so many ways, she is, I don't know what we expect sometimes, right? When we meet people who are sort of built up.
Larger than life, right?
Yeah, larger than life. And in many ways, she's just a really powerful leader and somebody who is sitting there across the table, like having a conversation. But then you see through her work ethic and through her ability to zero in on what is important, you see that person who no one else has been able to be a version of that also.
Yeah, she feels like a reincarnation of a god somehow. So then why do you think that's changed? Why do you think in the past 7-8 years, someone like her has been more involved? Is it just because we're all getting closer to each other in terms of culture and zeitgeist?
I think the change really happened over the course of the pandemic, where, of course, a lot of this happened before I joined. So it's some amount of it is speculation on my part. But I think Condé Nast as a company, it understood that in order to be a truly global brand, we need to actually all be talking to each other. We need to be sharing ideas. We need to be having global events and not be multiple versions of Vogue held to different standards and doing different things, sometimes cannibalizing each other, if at all. The benefit of that is that every week I get to talk to people, my counterparts in other parts of the world, people who are in Mexico and Italy and China, Taiwan, and really hear different perspectives, really learn from people who've been doing this a lot longer than I do. So sometimes it's as lame as me sending a quick WhatsApp message being like, hey guys, where's that drive link? And someone will send it to you. So it's sometimes as basic as that. And sometimes it's as elevated as, hey, there's this idea for an event and what do you think? And then different people will share their experiences and what they've learned, right? So it's like having a sisterhood. Because at this point, I think most of the heads of editorial content of the owned and operated markets are women. So it's like having this incredible sisterhood of talented women who really support each other and answer very quickly. I think all of us are also more digitally adept. And so sometimes it really is a WhatsApp group chat.
I would love to be on that WhatsApp group chat. And I'm sure most of the time it is that link to that drive, you know? I'm sure it is, that's day-to-day stuff to survive.
That's the thing. A lot of what we do is the job, you know? It's a job in all the very real ways a job is a job. It's a lot of meetings, it's a lot of planning, it's a lot of budgets, it's a lot of following up on things, chasing people. So we may be sitting there in a beautiful office, and in India we really do have a wonderful office. But it's not all, like, I don't know what people expect. It's not like drinking champagne at 4 a.m.
Because that's all they see, right? That's all they see.
Yeah, I guess that's the myth. And sometimes we need to protect that myth. But oftentimes it's a lot of hard work. Talented people working very hard and trying to create something that they believe in.
Yeah, you guys also have your versions of your 9-to-5.
It's very rarely a 9-to-5. I'll tell you
your
that.
Version, I mean, your version. I'm wrong. 9-to-9 yeah. Or 8-7-to-9. Yeah. Yes, yeah. No, totally. I mean, you and the other head of editorial content, others around the world, didn't get there by just drinking champagne. You know, let's be honest. The champagne is because you earned it.
Yeah, but that skill set does come in handy. Let's just say that.
Oh, trust me. I'm about to do that myself in a couple hours. Your predecessors are, you know, Megha Kapoor, Priya Thanna, who we talked about briefly. Were they able to kind of give you advice and feedback of how to kind of pick up where they left off at Vogue? And have they been able to guide you through the process?
Actually, I did something before I joined, is that I reached out to many of the people I admired in the old Vogue teams and asked them for some time to pick their brain. And I was so happy to say that everybody responded in the affirmative. And I spent a lot of time with them, asking them from the most banal to the most wacky, I think, questions. And everybody was very generous with their feedback and their advice. So I'm in touch with, I think, almost everybody. And yeah, they continue to guide me. So I've been quite lucky on that.
That's amazing to have those kind of mentors. So what should those of us, I know, kind of outside of India looking in, What should we know about what's going on with India fashion, Vogue content, the zeitgeist there? There's so much content to read and listen to and hear. What should we know right now? What's going on in India in terms of fashion, the luxury market?
There's a lot of stuff happening kind of at the same time. If you look from the fashion space, like luxury is increasingly booming in India, whether that's stemming from the corporatization of many of our Indian fashion designers. So you see two big corporates, the Reliance Group and then the Aditya Birla Group, are snapping up designers and kind of helping them just take their operations to the next level. So you can see what used to be a relatively disorganized business in this, I won't say disorganized, but unorganized business, is now becoming more organized. So designers are able to open up stores in cities that they would never have been able to do so on their own, right? So that's happening. And then at the same time, the Indian consumer has access to more disposable income. They're generally becoming wealthier. They're generally wanting the good life, which is true for many other developing nations. And so there's an appetite for luxury that before we would look at those pages or we would look at those images and you know, dream. Now people actively sort of work towards achieving that. So I would say in the luxury fashion space, that's what's happening. What's happening nationally is that there is an India pride that I see very clearly from the content pieces that resonate with people. Whenever we do a craft story or we do a story about an artisan, or and of course packaged in a way that makes it less jargon, more accessible. But anytime we're elevating anything that's made in India or a Indian craft, there people really appreciate that and they want more and they're hungry to learn more. So I feel that is also a shift where I'm not saying that we're looking inwards, but we're becoming more comfortable in our own skin and we're becoming happier to support Indian designers in a way that before, if you had, let's say, X amount of money, you would probably like spend it on a Gucci bag. And today you'd be comfortable spending that on, let's say, a Sabia or a Tarun. I'm not saying you're not going to buy the Gucci bag, but those same people are realizing that, you know, there are a lot of options in India. They're happy to support those options. And the opening up of parts of India that typically you wouldn't ever hear of, like Siliguri, for example, is a very small town in Bengal. And I hear about it all the time from different brands because they're talking about how Siliguri, the fashion scene is really booming. And I personally want to buy a ticket and head there and be like, what is going on here? Why do I hear
it? I just like the name of it.
Right. Like, it's cute. Yeah. It also has a Pride March, which I think is so amazing to have, like, this small town in India has its own Pride March. So I feel like that's another part of the zeitgeist that is so exciting for me as an Indian living in India, having lived here all my life, that there are parts of India that didn't get attention for a long time. I mean, I'm from Goa, and Goa is now the place that everybody either wants to move to, everybody wants to open up a business there, and there are a lot of parts to this that are more nuanced. But the fact is that typically Goa would have only been spoken about in the context of somebody planning a cheap vacation. And now the conversation is changing, and that's happening for many other parts of the country, like Mysore, Kochi, Indore, Chennai and Hyderabad are obviously flexing now. It's really an interesting time.
That is very interesting. I have many, many Goa stories. Too many typical Indian American going there for New Year's stories. We'll have to share one day.
I can imagine.
Politics everywhere nowadays is kind of crazy. Politics in India has changed quite a bit the past few years. How has that influenced you guys at all? Or do you guys totally stay away from the politics in India and what's going on?
I think that political cycles, especially in the age of social media, they kind of repeat themselves and they kind of, you see that reflection happening globally, right? We don't have much to do with it. It's also a factor of our license in India doesn't necessarily cover political content. So Vogue has traditionally stayed away from covering politics in any real way. And I would leave that to the experts because I myself am not a political journalist. And so I don't necessarily trust my ability to weigh in on matters of that nature in an official capacity.
It's stories we are always hearing over here. And so as I'm sure you guys hear about the politics going on in the US. So just, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's going to be a rough year, my friend. Obviously, Bollywood is intertwined with everything. You kind of answered it earlier, but I feel like, again, just from a reader's point of view, that you're able to balance out the content pretty well. How do you feel to bring in the Bollywood, but it feels like things are shifting a little bit?
There is no line in the sand that I can say, like, okay, we've done enough Bollywood and now we need to move. Or, you know, and at the same time that when we start to move in that direction, there'll be 50 people saying, oh, you know, now it's lost its glamour, it's lost its influence. So I feel like it is a work in progress. I obviously want to expand the ages of Vogue beyond. And even when we say Bollywood, we predominantly talk about like Hindi cinema originating out of Bombay, right? But there are so many other forms of cinema in this country. So the idea is to constantly question ourselves about who best represents the zeitgeist, who is somebody that people look up to, people admire. And another thing that I'm personally asking myself and asking my team to ask themselves is, how does this person exemplify what we want Vogue to stand for? So it's one thing for someone to be super famous and to look amazing and to have 25 million Instagram followers or whatever, right? But does that person exemplify what we would like Vogue to stand for in 2024, for example? And if the answer is no, then we won't necessarily engage, because if we don't feel comfortable and if we don't believe that this is a natural fit, then we can't convince our audience.
Yeah, you're not going to cover them just to cover them because of their name.
Exactly, right. Exactly. Right. So even with Bollywood, the hope is that we will find a way to do it that doesn't just feel breathless and overexcited and like, oh my God, anything that the celebrity does, we're, you know, all over it in complete support. Hopefully there will be a meaningful way in which to engage. And that is something that we're actively working towards.
I was just thinking, you know, there's so much crossover now with Bollywood stars coming to the Hollywood US markets, fashion designers coming here. We obviously now have a South Asian New York Fashion Week. South Asians are at Sundance here. I'm going to South by Southwest today. So it's just, there seems to be a lot of also crossover with Indian creatives and artists. How do you guys feel about that? Is that exciting to you to see that crossover?
It is exciting. The only thing that we have to be a little wary of is giving off the impression that if the West accepts somebody, a creative from India, that now they've truly arrived. That is something that I am very mindful of. It's that it's amazing for talents from any part of the world to be embraced and recognized by any part of the world that's not their home market or their home country. But I find it difficult to wrap my head around the idea that if, let's say, for example, there's a designer and for the past 20 years, you know, Indian celebrities have been wearing his designs and we've considered that par for the course. And now tomorrow, like, let's say Beyonce wears it. And now suddenly we're all completely losing it and shouting from the rooftops. For me, that portrays the Indian designer and their talent and their sort of hard work and legacy in a light that's not necessarily flattering to them and by extension, not necessarily flattering to the country. So I think going back to what I was saying earlier about that India pride now, I think that there is a little bit more that sense of self and saying that, you know, we don't need to be accepted by a particular country for us to feel that we've made it globally.
That's understandable. Although I think if Beyonce wore any of our clothes, we'd be pretty excited.
Maybe Beyonce is the only example which would justify.
Yeah, definitely. I think she transcends all countries. Any current projects you can talk about this year that you guys are working on or you're working on in particular?
We've got so many things and they're all like kind of happening at the same time. So as you can imagine, my brain is split into, I think, at least 64 different pieces across multiple time zones.
I can't imagine.
But we're like Vogue weddings, like I spoke about, that's something that we really believe in. We know that our audience looks to us to give them that voice, that credibility, that curation. So that's something that we are investing heavily in this year. Beauty is something that for the past few years, Vogue specifically took a bit of a step back. And beauty in this country right now is booming. I mean, every day there's a new brand being born. Every 2 days there's, you know, a new ingredient being discovered. So beauty is something that clearly there's a huge appetite for. So we are building up our beauty vertical and across all categories, across like print, social, digital, and also events. We also have Forces of Fashion, which will be in its third year this year. So Forces of Fashion is a fantastic global IP that most of the owned and operated Vogues across the world participate in. And this year it's going to be exciting to try and find a new rendition of it and how we can make it something bigger than last time, because the last time we had like an honor roll and we had the Forces of Fashion and we had so many designers who like reconnected with us and celebrated with us. It was quite exciting. And this year we're hoping to be able to give our audience a chance to participate as well. Most of our events tend to be closed door events, and we're looking to see if there's a way in which we can open our universe up a little bit to, you know, our wonderful readers who support us.
That's fantastic. It's been a long time. I moved out of India 2012. We hopped around Dubai and go around, went around the world with my husband's job. But coming back this year for the first time in 10 years, which for me is insane, because I used to come to India every summer. I have two little girls now, so bringing them for the first time to India, I'm very excited. It's very an emotional moment for me because it's just been such a long time. And they obviously know where we're from, but now as the second generation born here, it's getting harder and harder for them, for us to keep it going, keep the culture going. And I can't wait to bring them. So anyways, let's talk about your career. So I know you started as the youngest columnist in the Hindustan Times. So tell me about that really quick. What did you learn from that experience? How old were you?
I was 20.
20, wow. And how did you get that role? And was it scary?
It was scary, especially because that column had my photo on it. So everybody knew who I was. And it was a fashion police column, of course, something that would not survive even 20 hours in today's world. I would have been canceled instantly for saying the obnoxious things I did. But back then, the internet wasn't a thing. Obviously, I'm from the dark ages, as you know. And we didn't have the internet back then. So how I got it was essentially my editor at the time felt that I have a particular kind of sarcasm that if unleashed on the right victim could possibly bring in a lot of readership. And he was right. Having my photo there wearing horns certainly brought a lot of notoriety. What I learned is that it's important not to take yourself too seriously. And I also learned that I should be careful what I commit to any form of documentation, because it will come back to bite me.
I was about to ask you, I was like, is there anything that you maybe look back
at? Oh, yeah, plenty.
At? Okay.
Plenty.
Because, I mean, look, at 20 years old, I was saying so glad that there's no social media back then, basically. I'm from the dark ages, too. So I was like, I swear to God, if there was social media, my ass would have been canceled a long time ago.
Exactly. Repeatedly, probably.
Repeatedly, so for yes. Me, yes.
Because, I mean, when you're young, you really think that you're invincible. You have no concept of mortality or no concept of how long things stick around to hurt you. Now, of course, I'm very careful with what I say. And
I also think you don't realize when you're young how much you are going to change.
I mean, definitely you don't realize. But the frustrating thing is that the world at large doesn't seem to realize that you are changing. And every day, you're a new version of yourself. Because I feel like I see a lot of the people who are getting canceled today for things that they wrote 10, 15, 20 years ago. And I just feel like, what kind of world is this that you're not allowed to become a different person 20 years later and you still have to pay some kind of exacerbated penalty for some dumb idea?
I'm like, I'm going to make such an auntie comment right now. I'm so glad. I mean, I feel bad for these kids nowadays. I really do.
Oh, completely.
Like, I can't lie. I am glad I was born when I was, because it's just so stressful just to say anything. So I'm glad I got my jungliness out in my 20s. It was good. And then you co-authored Kareena Kapoor Khan's first book. How does it work to co-author someone's book like that, a celebrity's book? And was it an enjoyable experience?
It was enjoyable because, again, I was like 22 when the offer came to me. And it was because of the column that I got a lot
the
of
horns.
Notoriety.
Your horns. Your horns worked, yes.
Yeah. Somebody asked me if I would want to do this, and who says no, right? At that age, to an opportunity like this, you're just like, yeah, sure. It was interesting because I had never written a book before. I don't think I have it in me. I'm not the novelist type. I'm very much a journalist type of writer, which is like, can this 7,000 word piece be brought down to 600 words? And I can do that because I'm also an
editor.
Well,
you're not yet. You never know, Rochelle. You never know.
Who knows? So it was fascinating because it was a lot of time spent on sets, and I got to kind of see an insider perspective on Bollywood. And, you know, because I was writing this book, and she knew that she had complete control over ultimately what the content would be. It wasn't like I was, you know, writing some kind of expose or anything. So she was quite really herself. And it was so the experience goes that, like, exactly like this, right? I have a few questions and I'll ask her those questions. She'll give me her answers. And then I just write it in her voice. So it's not ghostwriting, because it was like Kareena Kapoor Khan with Rochelle Pinto, but it wasn't me writing about her. It was told through her voice.
It's like a very long ass interview. Into a book.
Imagine an interview that lasts a year, and then you have to find a way to like break it down into chapters, and then you have to go through the edits. And it was a really fun process. I was very young. Looking back at that book, when I read it, I'm like, oh my God, what was I thinking? As most writers should do, right? If you look back on a piece that you wrote 10, 15 years ago and you're like impressed with yourself, then that's not a good sign.
There is some growth that needs to happen.
100%.
Wow. 100%, well, yeah. Kudos for getting hired to write, co-author her book at 22. She must have liked something you've written in your column.
That's the thing. I feel like everybody at some point who has since then given me an opportunity or met me in some capacity has featured in the column, including Priya Tanna, by the way, who was the most great. She was so gracious about it. She was in the, obviously, again, me being a brat writing about anybody thinking, how is this ever going to hurt me?
I'm invincible. And then
exactly. And then at my first Vogue interview, she was my last round of interviews. And she was such a class act. She like asked me all the questions, nothing related to the column. And then literally at the very end, when I was leaving, she was like, oh, by the way, I remember you wrote about me in the column. And I think my blood just froze.
You're like, oh, God.
Yeah. I turned into a White Walker. I was just like, and she was like, oh, yeah, I just wanted you to know the dress was Loma. And I was like, okay.
You're like, so should I moonwalk out of here now? Or what's happening?
I was like, I'm definitely not getting this job. And then, of course, I did. So it just goes to show that that's what I mean. Like, you don't take yourself too seriously. I feel that's something I learned from her in that one instance where it must have been annoying to see some random 21-year-old writing trash about you, like, you know, with zero context. And of course, social media has now righted that balance, right? It's not a one-way street anymore where I can just pontificate on. I get the response pretty immediately. But yeah, it was a lesson in grace and learning when to shut the hell up, definitely.
Yeah. Well, also, I think it's another lesson in having faith in people too. Other people can laugh at themselves as well, right? Like not everyone's going to write those comments on social media.
And not everyone is going to take it to the grave and like try to find a way to exact a vendetta. Yeah. It's like no one thinks about you that much. No
Seriously,
one has that much
you're
time
not
for
that
anybody
important.
Else.
You're not that important. Yeah, that's like the main thing my parents will always tell me. Like, you're thinking about this. It's not that important. You're not that important. It's fine.
Yeah.
Like, everything is going to be
but
fine.
But that lesson I feel has really helped me at Vogue, because like anytime I get a little tripped up about, oh, how will this be perceived and what will people think of it? And I'm just like, nobody cares. Like, really.
It's so freeing. I remember when I first launched this podcast a long time ago and I published my first, you know, 3-4 episodes. And I'm sure, you know, with podcasts, it takes, unless you're like a celebrity, it takes a while to build up. I was not sleeping that first night after I published that first episode. And everyone's like, dude, no one's going to listen. Like, like at all. You might have like one listener and that might be your mom. It's just not that important. You're not that important. It's fine. And that's been the most freeing part of this podcast. I'm like, oh, whatever. It's not a big deal. So. Okay. And then really quickly, I would love for you to tell me about Tweak. You were a founding editor at Tweak, which is Twinkle Khanna's media company. What was your role and is it still around?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely still around. And my role was like founding editor. And that also in many ways made me chief everything officer, because it's a startup and because, you know, it's being run in a manner that is really authentic. And the founder is someone who has immense credibility and, you know, the entire country has deep respect for her. I personally admire her and, you know, she's been something of a mentor in many ways. It was a partnership. Really, we would joke about the fact that we speak to each other way too much. We talk to each other more than either of us talk to our respective partners or any family member. And with Twinkle, I really learned how to put your money where your mouth is. In that, if this is what you set out to do, then do it. Do it completely. Be willing to withstand waves of criticism, or, you know, withstand slow periods and low periods and even periods of confusion where you're like, is this the direction in which I want to go? Which doesn't mean to say that you shouldn't pivot when the time is right. But I think that she has such a deep sense of conviction in what she believes in, and she's actually willing to stand by her principles, that was honestly, as an editor and as a content person, that is the most empowering thing. When you know that your boss or the person who's responsible for the company is not going to turn around and say, how could you do that? Just because, you know, something went badly,
right,
beyond
right.
what was anticipated.
You're criticized or whatever.
Yeah. Like, it's not, you're not like constantly pandering to the audience. You understand what you're trying to do. Yeah. So that was my learning experience at Tweak. I've spent 5 years there. The team is amazing. We really like lived, breathed.
Like a startup environment at first. Is that how it felt?
It fully was a startup environment. And we learned to do, I think it was the best education of my life, because we learned to do so many things as we were doing them. Like, I had no idea how to do it. I was like, okay, well, got to do it anyway. And then along the way we learned, right? And when you have a leader like Twinkle, who is like, I got your back.
Allows you to kind of do your thing and not worry about, yeah. Oh my God, is there going to be repercussions for this? Yeah.
Exactly. And because she was so deeply involved, I knew that she also believed in the same thing. So yeah, I feel like it was MBA school where I actually got paid to do this MBA, and I got made a lot of friends, I think people love Tweak in a way that I hadn't seen before in my career in media, where people love a brand because they really feel like the brand resonates with them and sees them and understands them.
It feels like, the little I know of it, it feels like it could potentially, or maybe does, have a cult following in a way.
It does. It has I don't know if I would say cult following, but it definitely has a very strong, loyal, very vibrant community. Yeah, and a loyal community. And so I've tried to take some of the lessons that I learned at Tweak into Vogue to try and build that sense of loyalty to the brand again. Yeah, let's see how we fare.
Well, that's pretty awesome that you've experienced, you know, kind of the startup environment to this well-oiled machine, right? Kind of things they've kind of bounced around everywhere, which is, I think it's so lucky to have both those experiences to kind of hone in on different kind of skills, right? Growing up in Goa. So obviously, I mentioned before, my Goa experience is typical Indian American bullshit New Year's. I did go a few more times and you know, hang out in the nice resorts as I got older and calmer. But growing up there, I've only really known Bombay and Delhi. I would love to know more about kind of your childhood and the culture of Goa compared to other parts of India.
I'm so glad you asked me that, because I feel like I'm something of an unpaid ambassador for my home state. It is truly the most unique and freeing part of the country to grow up in, especially if you're a woman, because you grow up with a very natural understanding that there isn't really any difference between women and men or girls and boys. Because it's a small state, the state is able to invest a little more, at least used to be. Okay, let me just, the caveat that all of this is when I was growing up, okay, and I haven't lived there for a very long time now. You get this very healthy mix of being in nature, so being connected to nature, which, as you know, has so many intangible benefits, right? Just being rooted in a way that I don't think a lot of people who grew up in cities are. And I don't mean rooted as in humble and simplicity and all of that. I just mean actually rooted, like understanding the world around you and how you play a very tiny but significant role in everything that happens, right? With an urban mindset. So it was like being in nature, but having a relatively urban mindset, because it is a liberal population and it is homogenous in as far as everybody kind of, our culture is quite shared. So you won't see very stark divides between communities or religious backgrounds or anything. And I love the time that I grew up in, because it was super secular. It was safe. Like, we really celebrated every festival together. We really spent time in each other's homes. We all played sports together. We all went swimming. So there was really no, I can't remember ever feeling a boundary being forced on me by society. And so as an Indian woman, I can't imagine a better culture. Like, my dad taught my sister, my mother, and me to ride bikes, drive cars, swim. And my dad used to teach me, he would be like, you should never need a man to do anything. So he taught me to like change taps, change light bulbs, change tires. It was, you know, it was a very egalitarian upbringing. And it was easy to do in a place like Goa. And so there was a lot of independence from a very young age, a lot of which I feel have shaped my career path. Because, and also I grew up in a middle class home where my parents were both working parents. And it was very clear that work is something that you take seriously. Ambition is something to be cultivated. Mm-hmm. Things don't just, as you know, the typical Indian parent thing, things don't fall from the trees. Money doesn't grow on trees.
Many, many times. Like that. What did your parents do?
My dad has kind of done a little bit of everything, but he is at his very heart and soul a performer who happened to find himself in the event management space. And my mom, she used to work for the Life Insurance Corporation of India. So she was really like the stable rock of the family with a steady 9-to-5 job. And while my dad was like the experimental one who had a lot of different callings before he found his...
He was the entrepreneur, right? Like, he was the one trying different things.
He was trying different things. Yeah.
And I think also, I'm going to stereotype here, but I think a lot of women in India, even Indian women here back then, didn't work as much. And so seeing your mom working must have had a huge impact on you.
Absolutely. Because my mom was, she was a working mom, but she would make sure that I had a fresh breakfast every day, and breakfast was different every day. So I don't even know, like, she would wake up at 5:15 and then she would pray. So I also understand that like discipline and rigor is something that I really learned from my mom. And then she would cook breakfast, get us off to make us go to school, then do an entire day's work, come back, make sure we did our homework, all of that. Not to say that my dad wasn't around for all of this, but it was an anomaly, I would say, to see a woman who had this level of energy and this level of, like, we had obviously help when my sister and I were really young, but my mom was cooking, she was doing everything. So I feel like, you know, I get asked this question often enough, like, who are your idols? And I'm not going to be lame and say, oh, my mom. But I feel like what often happens is that we immediately think of famous people. You know, when somebody asks you, who's your icon, who's your idol? And I really feel like, you know, famous people are famous. Mm-hmm.
But congratulations.
I don't know if I find their story as interesting as these stories of people who've really like transformed their lives and risen above. Both my parents, by the way, are, you know, they had epilepsy when they were kids.
Both of them?
Yeah, both
That's
of them.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So they were like, oh my gosh, like what genetic code are we passing on?
That's smart. Okay.
Yeah, but what is so cool is that they kind of, you know, my dad really pushed my mom. He was like, you don't need to let this disease prevent you from doing the things that you want to do. So he taught her to ride the bike and drive a car and all of those things. So for me to see both my parents who come from very different backgrounds and who really overcome the baggage that was holding them back, the inherited baggage that was holding them back, and really make a life for themselves, I feel like that everyone calls their parents their heroes. I'm not going to use the word hero, but I have learned so much by observation. In every aspect, like their conflict resolution techniques, their the way that they are constantly noticing who needs help, and without making a big hue and cry of it, they like quietly go and offer help when help is needed, and sometimes even when it's not. Their ability to be empathetic and be excited for life. Like my dad at the age of 65 is teaching himself multiple musical instruments because he feels like finally he now has the time to do that. So. And my mom wants to travel and she's very open about like, I want to go everywhere. She has a bucket list and...
Good for her!
Right. So there's a certain joy for life that they're in their 60s now that has not dimmed in any way. And I think that for me, that's such an interesting future to look at.
Yeah. It seems like you... I mean, I feel like your parents are my icon too now. And by the way, I think it's not cheesy to say that they are because... Who has impacted you the most in life? My parents have. And now as a mother, like, obviously I'm not hoping to be their icon, but I'm hoping to have an impact on them. You know, I now realize the role of being a mom and how powerful it is actually more than anything else. But it feels like you had this perfect trifecta of seeing your mom you know, obviously be there for you guys, but also having her own life and her own passion career, having a dad who's, you know, so supportive, having a healthy relationship with your father, which I'm assuming was your main male figure growing up. And then growing up in a place like Goa, and I don't want to call it island culture. And island, by island culture, I mean freeing in a way, you know. But also, I don't know, to me, in the 45 minutes we've talked, I obviously know your role, but it does feel like that humbleness has come with you. I mean, just from observation.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, Ami, like when I go back home, I stay with my parents. I sleep in the same bed that I slept in when I was 17. My parents don't understand necessarily my job. So the questions they ask me are just like,
I love that. That's so cute though.
They're just like, there's no space to believe in your own myth, because people have far more important things going on than caring about whether their daughters, I mean, they'll be very excited for this podcast and they'll forward it on WhatsApp to their entire community. My teachers from first grade will get this link, you know. So
everyone, Rochelle's very, very nice. You should be all there.
But my parents aren't at all, I would say, intimidated or excessively interested in the healthiest way. I can leave that world at the door and come home and just be me. And I think that is something that I have learned from them. And I try to explain that to my team also. I try to be that person in every interaction. So, because jobs, you know, this it's a seat, you know. I'm in the seat today. I will not be in the seat tomorrow. If I attach my identity completely to this seat, then what happens when it is taken away from me or I decide to move on? I'd never want to be that person who is like at sea because the way they thought of themselves their entire life, no, is no longer their reality.
This is why you have the Shanti over you, I feel like. I can't think of a better word, but I think it also started off when you were 20 doing this column. I think you have just tried these different things, worked hard at it for sure, but I think you said it best, you haven't taken yourself too seriously. You've done the work, you've done the job, but also realize this is what I do, not who I am.
Absolutely. I think I learned that a long time ago. Honestly, in my friend circle, I feel like I may have one of the more glamorous jobs, but I don't think I have the most, you know, like in a very critical sense. I feel like I know a lot of my friends who are doing things that are super critical, and I just somehow don't feel like I should be patting myself on the back for, you know, I know I've worked very hard and I continue to work very hard. I would like to think that I will never give somebody an opportunity to say that she's phoning it in, because I just don't believe that. I wasn't raised in that kind of environment. But I know that it is a job and I'm deeply grateful for it, but it doesn't define me.
But let me tell you, Rochelle Bean, like I've interviewed a lot of leaders, you know, obviously tons of people that are doing big jobs. This attitude is what I believe makes a true leader. Because if you really do think I'm the shit, you know, whatever we talked about, I do think you are more prone to fail at the end of the day. Kudos to auntie and uncle for raising such a wonderful daughter.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll do a quick fast round. Biggest pet peeve?
Dishonesty.
Celebrity crush?
Yuval Noah Harari.
I haven't heard that one yet. Very good. Ultimate collaboration for this year?
Oh, that's a good one. I don't think I've even had time to think about that. Maybe if I get Yuval Noah Harari to write a piece.
All right. I was going to say that or Beyonce, but you know. Alternate universe. If you weren't doing this, what else would you be doing?
100%. I would be a farmer. I've thought about this deeply, by the way.
So this is not, I love it. I was like, wow, she answered really quick.
Oh, no. This is like an ongoing daydream.
Okay.
To be a farmer in a collective that is close enough to the city that so it's self-sustaining, but it also offers city people a chance to engage with nature. I will send you my business proposal at the end of this.
Yes, please do. I love this. It's amazing.
I have thought this through very deeply. And I, hopefully one day.
Okay, Rochelle, this is what I see. I see you, 10 years, whatever, having the farm and writing your book. This is what's going to happen.
Oh my gosh,
yes,
amazing.
Yes, yeah, call me in 10 years, girl. What's going to happen? I don't know if you have a bucket list, but if you do, what's one thing you want to check off this year?
Oh gosh, I mean, these are really tough questions. I was gonna go with like travel, but okay. Bucket, yeah, I guess it would be like to see more parts of this world than I currently have seen.
And
yeah,
any place in particular that you're dying to go to?
I would say Central Asia, because I feel like there's so much happening in Central Asia right now. I'm just so fascinated by these countries that most of us would not be able to pick out on a map. And I want to see what's going on there. Because for me, I'm deeply interested in parts of this world that I know nothing about. It's not exciting for me to go to like LA or, not to say it's not exciting, but it's not as exciting than to encounter a culture that I have zero idea about. And to have all my preconceived notions shattered, that is very exciting for me.
You know, that I think that awakens the soul more than anything in the world. You know, just going somewhere new that you have no clue about. And this is not the same thing as Central Asia. I'm going to Ireland in 2 weeks. I've never been.
Oh, lovely.
I've had this dream of doing a road trip with my three best friends since, I don't know, I was 20.
Yeah.
And I know Ireland's not like exotic or I don't know, just always wanted to go. And we're doing it in 3 weeks. And
Amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you. I know. I'm like, it's really hard after two kids to like get out and do it. I mean, we travel, of course, but like do a girls trip for a week. I still need to tell them, my kids, but that's okay. Tuckered Out is hosted by me, Ami Tucker. This episode is produced by Genie Media with Jeannie Saraswathy, Ashley Tuff, Micah Sweetman, Hans Andres, and Laura Radescu. You can follow me at Tuckered Out Podcast on Instagram. And please subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcast.